afternoon. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Susie Larson, and this is Live the Promise, and we are here to help you engage in a strong and active walk of faith. So glad you tuned in, and boy, this is an important show today and a very engaging conversation. And because we're talking about opioid addiction and all that goes with it, this may not be a conversation suitable for younger ears. So if you've got little ones listening, you might want to get them busy doing something else. But listen to this. When Rick Van Warner found himself searching abandoned buildings for his missing son, he had no idea that the synthetic pill form heroin that had snared his teen was already killing so many. In the years of pain and heartache that followed as he tried to save his son from addiction, Van Warner discovered what the public has just recently become aware of. Prescription opioids are so addictive that even short-term use can create dependency, igniting an epidemic that now claims nearly 100 American lives each day. Rick Van Warner wrote the book On Pills and Needles, The Relentless Fight to Save My Son from Opioid Addiction. We will get him on in 1 minute. I just got to tell you quickly, at Faith Radio, we're giving away a systematic theology Bible, one every week. This is a major gift. Wow, I love that we can do this and happy to do it for you. So all you have to do is hop on our website and sign up to win. MyFaithRadio.com. You'll see right there on the homepage the opportunity. And if you don't get the Bible in your mail this week, you can sign up next week. You can keep trying each week of the month, and I hope you do actually win, because what a great resource for your study. Well, my guest writes this. He says, how could this have happened? How could this 16-year-old, who less than a week earlier had left home on a typical Friday morning for school, could now be flirting with death by overdose? Let me tell you about my guest. We'll get him on the show. Rick Van Warner is a 30-year veteran of journalism, crisis management, and media relations. He was compelled to share his personal story to help other families after recognizing the endemic nature of the current opioid addiction epidemic. Always willing to tackle tough challenges, he also volunteered as a social worker within the New York State Youth Justice Division, where he counseled teens confined to group homes after committing serious crimes. He lives in Central Florida with his family. We're glad to have him with us today. Dear Rick, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Good to have you. And we always start by talking scripture, and you chose a passage from Colossians chapter 3. Why don't you read that verse for us and talk to us about it?
Certainly. The verse is, put on then, as God's chosen ones, holy and beloved, compassionate hearts, kindness, humility, meekness, and patience, bearing with one another, and if one has a complaint against another, forgiving each other, as the Lord has forgiven you. So you must also forgive. And above all, put on love, which binds everything together in perfect harmony. Mm. So what that means to me is that there's an unconditional love that we have to extend to our children and our loved ones and our friends who are struggling with addiction. It's a terrible affliction that impacts a lot of people, and there's a lot of families going through it. And I think the most important thing is the only solution is love and acceptance is above all else. So when we were going through the early years of this situation with our teenager, it was very much not losing hope and not losing faith that got us through, and I think that's why he's alive today.
It's absolutely such a gripping story. How about if you do this? Go back and tell us what Tommy was like before his introduction to drugs, and then how was he first introduced to drugs?
Well, we have four children, and he was the middle son, so second born, and he was very much a creative, happy-go-lucky, sweet, you know, very gentle child, wouldn't kill a fly. Really probably, you know, more type B than type A, more creative than his brothers who were a little more rough and tumble. And he just was a great kid and seemingly had a normal, happy childhood. I mean, they were all raised in a Christian family in a suburban, well-off home. And he first found, OxyContin in the high schools of, high school halls where the kids were starting to experiment with it. And at that time, it was as prevalent and as easy to get as one officer once told me as candy at a 7-Eleven.
Wow. Wow. And you say that opioids prescribed for even minor pain for a short time are so addictive that it could take only a few days and it creates a dependency. Say more about that.
Well, the opioids are a very dangerous drug that rewires brain chemistry. So it really started with the pharmaceutical opioid OxyContin, and then later other oxycodone type drugs that were, they originally featured a time release mechanism, which is the only way that the drug maker got the FDA approval. Problem is that time release mechanism was neutralized by just crushing a pill, so then they could get the full dose by smoking or snorting or injecting it. So once they finally did crack down on access, it was still a huge problem today in terms of overprescribing of these pills, and we've seen a lot of lawsuits of late against the pharmaceutical companies that have deceptively marketed and flooded the market with them over the years. But once they cracked down on trying to, you know, limit a little more the access to the pills, it pushed the problem into the streets, because you have even more people addicted than ever before, and they turn to heroin and street versions of opioids, such as heroin, fentanyl, and you know, copycat street version pills, often cut with dangerous chemicals.
Yeah, because they're hooked.
Have just continue to go up.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they can get hooked so fast, and then suddenly they'll take anything because they've really lost their wits about, no matter what it is, I need to get that high. So when he was first introduced, how long before you knew something was going on, and what started to change in his personality?
One of the frightening things about opioid use is, unlike other things that you might expect a teenager, an American teenager, to experiment with, such as alcohol or marijuana, there's really no telltale. There's no odors. There's no, you know, obvious bloodshot eyes or anything of that nature. It's as though everything is normal. It's very, very hard to detect, which again is why it was something that became in favor in schools, because they were able to use and not be detected. We didn't see a problem in our son until we started seeing his grades slipping a little bit, and there, you know, started to see some attitude changes, just a little more dispassionate, less engaged, a little more defiant. But it's pretty tough to, you know, for anyone who's raised children, when you're about that 15, 16 year age is about when those sorts of things in a normal sober child start to occur at times. So, you know, it's not unusual for a teenager to be, you know, start to be a little defiant or test their boundaries. Mm. So at first it didn't seem like anything was wrong until he disappeared and didn't come home. Mm. And we had to search for him for a few days and luckily found him in time, but he was already, unbeknownst to us, in the throes of opioid addiction.
And from that point until he came clean, how much time passed?
Well, 9 years and counting.
Amazing. I mean,
we have been through, you know, the ringer.
It's, yeah. Hell and back. I mean, yeah, really.
Really, very much so. And it's been very difficult on our family, on our marriage, but we've managed to persevere and really fight through it. I think, you know, my son at this point has been through, you know, 13 relapses. He's been in jail a couple times for possession. He's been he's been homeless a couple times along the way, where we just didn't know where he was. And, you know, he's twice been resuscitated from death by overdose. But today he is doing very well and is clean and happy.
Wow. You know, as you, the story is so gripping. Again, the title of the book, On Pills and Needles, what a gripping title even. But, I mean, I felt my stomach knot up as I'm reading these different scenarios in your book, Rick, where you're at the sidelines watching your other son play football, and you're smiling because he has this great play, and just then you get a call, and it's about Tommy. And I'm wondering about how often that juxtaposition happened for you, where you had a sweetness and then a sorrow totally upstage it because of what was going on with him.
Always. It was always like that, it seemed. It's a roller coaster. It's just a terrible roller coaster. And we learned to live in somewhat hope neutral, is what I called it, because, you know, you didn't want to ever give up hope that he would somehow find the way. We knew God had a plan for him or he wouldn't be alive. And yet we became accustomed to him falling and to him and to, you know, small periods of happiness being followed by long periods of despair. So it was very, very difficult and very much a roller coaster. And it was all like that. And that's very tough on your other children, too, because children want the spotlight.
And they all have needs. Yeah, and they all have to have times where they're in the spotlight. And that doesn't happen when you've got an addict in the family. And we're going to pause here when we come back. I would love for you to talk more just about the impact. And you think about this, how long this went on. And your dear son Tommy steals your laptop. He steals money from friends. He's stealing things from his own siblings. How do you rebuild after that? And I would love to know the catalyst of what brought him back. But even this public health crisis, what can we do about it and what's being done about it? Talking to Rick Van Warner, his book on pills and needles, The Relentless Fight to Save My Son from Opioid Addiction. We've got three copies. You're not going to be able to put it down. Email livethepromise@myfaithradio.com. Put pills and needles in the subject line. Please remember that mailing address, and we'll be back in a minute. Tuning in today, I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise, talking to Rick Van Warner. He's a 30-year veteran of journalism, has a son who was introduced to opioids in school, and it didn't take long, and he was instantly hooked. 9 years of in and out of treatment centers, up and down and around, and truly, their story is like a walk through hell. What you look and read about what they've been through. His book is titled On Pills and Needles, The Relentless Fight to Save My Son from Opioid Addiction. And Rick, I have three sons. They're grown and they're married, but I just, when you would convey your wife's passion in her heart, and I mean, I could feel it, because there's nothing like a mama's heart for her son. And there's times you said where she just wanted to just smother him in love and then keep track of his every moment. And at those times you were feeling just anger, resentment, like, get out of my sight, I'm so betrayed by you. I mean, talk about just that dynamic and how you both sorted through all of your heartbreak.
Well, it's I never have lost a child, thank God, but I would say that I have a couple of close friends that have, and I think that, and I've seen it destroy marriages. So it's a similar type of thing when you're grieving your son while he's alive, because you come to believe he's not going to survive, then it's hard to be on the same page. And in a sense, we switched roles often, you know, over the years. There would be periods where she just was ready to say no more and turn him out. And I was the one that insisted we not give up and keep him home. And then there were times when the shoe was on the other foot. So it was very much a back and forth. I think that the strength we had as being married as long as we have, and just know we found a way to, one of us would take it on, take the burden on for a period and give the other a break, if you will. So I was always the one that would drive him on the long drive to the next recovery attempt, you know, and that always provided a small period of respite, if you will. But by the same token, I came to understand that the power of this condition of addiction, which is really a complex, you know, stew of brain chemistry, socialization, potentially probably a piece of its genetic predisposition. It's complex, and a lot of times it's very linked with a person's underlying condition, such as a social anxiety or a mild depression. And so we're just beginning to understand the human brain, and there's a lot of factors that go into it, but it, at the very root of most addiction, especially this type of addiction, is a feeling of worthlessness, isolation, low self-esteem. So if you start to think that through and you start to live that with someone like we did with our son, then you start to question is it really the best strategy to just, you know, send him and, you know, put the family further into debt by spending thousands more on another recovery program? And none seemed to work for him, and along the way, it dawned on me that, you know, in a sense, that's kicking the can down the road because it gives the family a little breathing room for a while, but it, ultimately, it's not solving the problem. And so we started doing detox and recovery when he would relapse at home, and started just making sure we just wouldn't give up on him. We just swallowed him up in the family and included him in everything, and stopped giving a hoot about what the neighbors thought or anybody else thought. I mean, he's our son, and we just, I'm convinced that he's alive because he knows he had a family that loved him that much and just wasn't going
to
give up on him.
You had to die to so many things. I didn't even think about the neighbors, but I mean, all of the things you had to die to fight for his life, it's just, it's staggering. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's reading in your book about how the pharmaceutical industry would make this so accessible that they would mail these packages to homes to get OxyContin and to get these opioids.
Absolutely.
It made it very accessible. I mean, this is a total dumb and obvious question, but I still want you to speak to it. Have to go through a period of forgiveness for the pharmaceutical industry, because I would feel outraged at the accessibility for your young teenager.
Well, to be truthful, I have not reached forgiveness to the pharmaceutical mm-hmm. industry, and probably I probably need to at some point, because I do believe very deeply in forgiveness in general as part of my faith. But in this case of the pharmaceutical industry, this problem is a man-made problem. They created this epidemic that is killing over 100 Americans every single day.
Wow.
They killed more Americans last year than the American lives that were lost during the entire Vietnam War. You stop to think about that for a minute. How do we have a kind of problem that is killing over 100 Americans, is the leading cause of accidental death in America, more than car accident shootings or anything else, and yet there's nobody marching in the street about it?
Yeah.
And I think that the reason for that is the politicians turned a blind eye to it for years, because Big Pharma spends $250 million a year lobbying, and companies are deceptive. And when the few times that they have tried to bring justice to some of the drug makers behind these pills, they've just, you know, the hundreds of millions of dollars of fines, for instance, against one of them, compared to
nothing.
The billions they're pocketing every year, mm-hmm. is just a drop in the bucket. So it was allowed to go on unchecked for well over a decade before anybody even recognized the issue.
I just got to say, you know, God is a God of justice, and I so wonder how that's going to play out, because he's fierce for his children. And when you think anybody does anything to any one of these children, you might as well put a millstone around your neck. And I think it's when there's something systemic to the point that it's causing the deaths of people and premature deaths of children. I mean, I just imagine, what does accountability look like, God? How are you going to play this out? I'm just curious. But another thing I noticed, my boys, a couple of them wandering in the ways of the world for a little while, just I wanted to die. I was so heartbroken because of the way we raised them. But I realized that it brought up my own stuff to the surface that needed dealing with, you know, my own fears and my own attachment to their behavior. And you were so gritty and honest, Rick, about just how you guys, that did the same for you, because your heart is so attached to their heart. But it brings up, I'm like, you had issues with your own dad who was not good to you. Talk about just how your stuff surfaced and how you managed to deal with that.
Well, it brought up, you know, when you're raising sons, I think there's a particularly unique dynamic between fathers and sons, much like mothers and daughters. But I think that there's, you know, my father's era was brought up to not show emotion, you know, not to, you know, men don't cry, men don't say I love you or hug as much, you know. It's certainly a different way than I brought my sons up. So I've always been very conscious of trying to be a better father than I had. Through these struggles, when I saw the depth of my son's despair and just how low an opinion that he had of himself once the drugs had started rewiring his brain, it was heartbreaking, and it made me realize that there's something more to this than just the drugs. You know, it's more than just a physical addiction. Otherwise, why does he continue to relapse time and time again? And that's when I really understood that this is a drug of escape from emotional pain for people in most cases. This is not the type of drug that somebody takes so they can get high and go to a concert or go to a, you know, have a day in the meadow or whatever. This is a drug of usually people do it by themselves and in isolation. It's really a terrible drug to escape from, as my son told me one time, when I just don't want to feel anything. That's what he would use.
Well, we've got 2 minutes.
So when you start to... Go ahead.
Sorry. I was going to say, we have 2 minutes to our hard break at the bottom of the hour, and you can carry this answer to the other side if you need to. But so would you say that there are some kids who are taking this drug, maybe getting it from school, out of maybe curiosity? So maybe they don't have low self-esteem. It sounded like Tommy was just a sweet spirit and a loving heart. And, I mean, some may go there because they want to escape, but others may be taking it because it's there and they're trying to be cool, but it can change their physiology and their brain chemistry to the point where they can then go into that place where they feel worthless.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because I think that in Tommy's case, he started as something to try, he did have trouble finding a group. And if your child doesn't find a group in high school, then they end up in what I call the island of misfit toys, which is the disenfranchised group, and that tends to be the group most at risk for drug use. But I have no doubt that he started out not taking it as a drug of emotional escape as much of a drug to just experiment with, and that it did ensnare him fairly quickly.
Mm. Now, a number of years ago, I interviewed a dad whose young 20-something daughter committed suicide because she was on multiple meds for anxiety and depression, and he said that altered her brain chemistry. There was no oversight with these multiple meds that they kept giving her, but it changed her whole thought process, and she committed suicide. And he was also, you know, advocating for it. This, we got to do this differently, and boy, these are important conversations to have today. Talking to Rick Van Warner, his book is gripping. It's titled On Pills and Needles, The Relentless Fight to Save My Son from Opioid Addiction, and I just want you to know ahead of time, Tommy lives, and we're going to get an update on how he's doing. But just talking about the impact of the family, and maybe you've got a prodigal, maybe you've got an addict for a son or daughter, and you've got questions. We're not taking calls, but you sure can email me, and I'll try to pass the question to Rick. Susie@myfaithradio.com. Don't go away. We'll be back in a minute. Glad you tuned in today. I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise, talking to Rick Van Warner. He's a 30-year veteran of journalism whose son in high school and junior high, if I remember right, as a teenager, young teenager, got hold of some opioids in school. And what I've learned through reading his book is it can take just a few days, a short stint of use, to create a significant dependency, which happened with Tommy, Rick's son, a 9-year battle in and out, 13-something treatment centers. I mean, almost died a couple of times. What this family went through because of this addiction is just mind-boggling. And you write in the book, Rick, you said, what has been lost when teenagers no longer have the patience or courage to drop their social media personas long enough to share face-to-face conversations about their insecurities and challenges with others going through the same thing? Speak to that, if you would.
Yeah, I think that we've lost a lot. Social media has become such a prevalent thing that people are just constantly in the quest of Instagram and Snapchat and Facebook and trying to be somebody or have the cutest picture or, you know, get the likes, get the quote unquote friends. You know, I just think we're just beginning to understand what that's done on that generation. And I think it's one of the things that, from my perspective, that it's done is it's dulled just the normal type of kid-to-kid interaction that used to go on. And it's unbelievable to me when you get a group of kids together that they're all on their phones. Mm-hmm. That half the time they're not even talking to each other. Mm-hmm. Or a family in a restaurant where all four people are on a phone. Mm-hmm. And so what are we losing in terms of that you know, being able to explain and open up to how you're feeling without feeling that you're going to be judged for it. So I think that's what I'm referring to.
You know, Rick, I was flying out for a conference, my hubby and I, to speak at a conference, and I'm sitting in one of those little short booths at the airport with a little short half wall, so there's another booth right next to us.
Yep.
And there was a mom and a girl, I would say she was in middle school, and the mom had her face so buried in the phone. We were there for 2 hours waiting for our flights. We were working on our laptops, and that girl had her little fist on her cheek, and she'd ask her mom questions. Her mom never once said one thing to acknowledge her. She maybe made a groan or whatever, but I mean, she asked her so many questions that never got answers. So she finally said, "Mom, the house is on fire," and she never looked up. And I just thought, you know, we always talk about kids who will not take their faces off their phones, but, you know, their parents, too, that are,
absolutely.
It took all my strength not to say, "Excuse me, she's going to grow up fast. Take some time with her. She's dying to talk with you right now." But that feels like such an issue. We're not even apt at conversations with each other because we're so insecure. I think both adults and kids, you know?
Yeah. Addiction is one of the, you know, the phone addiction is one of the forms of addiction. And I know that we're just beginning to understand what this, there's studies coming out now that show that this this phone obsession and kind of what we're talking about, it releases dopamine. So there's a positive, you know, experience that's, you know, it's almost fulfilling the brain. It's rewiring the brain chemistry in a way, even that.
Wow.
Some of the obsession with, and we're just understanding it. There's brain chemistry studies that relate to soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan suffering from post-traumatic stress. And we're just beginning to, just scratching the surface on understanding how powerful and how uniquely different everyone's brain chemistry is. When it comes to opioids and similar substances, it's particularly haywiring when it comes to someone's brain chemistry, and it takes a year or more of sobriety for that to ever get back into on track. It can, apparently the brain can repair itself, but again, it's the last frontier of medical science, and we're just now beginning to understand the complexities that are involved.
Here's a question from a listener. Our 38-year-old son is addicted to heroin. We've been devastated by this realization, but have been dealing with a deviant behavior since high school. It's possible he's been using drugs all these years. My question is, how much do we involve ourselves with his life at this point? And then how do we show love without enabling? God bless you, dear one. What do you say, Rick?
Well, I think that there has to be boundaries, particularly when you get to the age of an adult child. We had to, you know, close our door. Yeah, we had to. There were periods when he was stealing and actively using, and it was evident that that we had to turn him out. But we always turned him out with love. We always let him know how much we loved him and how much we would love to help him, but only he can help himself. So you have to have certain boundaries to preserve the family, and at the same time, when they do want help, they if they turn back up, then you do everything you can possibly do to help them and not give up on them. But there's no easy answer. There are no silver bullets to this. If at the end of the day, it's very difficult as a parent, no matter how old your child is, to understand that you really have no control at the end
of the
day. They have the control and God has the control. So, you know, there's a saying, let live, let God. And you have to put it to a big degree in his hands. But I think the hardest thing is to understand that when somebody is in that state of using, they're not reasoning with them is a waste of time. Their brain only is, again, physiologically wired to want more drugs. That's just the way it is. And it's extraordinarily difficult for a person in that state to pull themselves out and to be able to get over the physical withdrawal, but just the whole brain cravings of wanting more. And that's what makes this so difficult to break out of the cycle. And I think that you can only help them in that position by expressing love and acceptance, but not, you know, you do have to have boundaries, no doubt about it.
How did Tommy's addiction affect the siblings, the rest of the family?
Well, you know, there's the saying, a little bit like the lost son parable that you hear. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you're familiar with the lost son parable, where the one son takes his half of his inheritance or whatever, goes out and squanders it, then comes back and is welcomed with just love and a huge feast. Well, there was a lot of that in my family because we were so, when Tommy wanted to be clean and when he came back to the home, and we would embrace him, and to the chagrin after a while over the years of some of his, of his siblings, who felt really out of concern for us more so than anything else. They were trying to protect us, but you can't understand it if you don't have a child. Yeah. You don't understand.
Yeah.
And so we had quite a few discussions, and there were times they just thought we were fools to let them come back. But it's how, when you start to understand you're dealing with a person who is not well and is very fragile, and you do whatever it takes to keep them afloat and to keep them from going under. And it's worked because the kids eventually came around to it. I mean, they're grown now. They don't live at home except for Tommy has recently come home. And we've brought him home again, and he's been doing great for the last few months. He's saving up enough so he can go and move on with his life.
Hmm. Did they have to go through a hard process of forgiveness with all the broken promises and all of the attention that went to him?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. There was, and not to mention the stealing from them and again, he sucked all the air out of and energy out of the family.
Yeah.
And so it's certainly we all have some scars from it.
Well, what was the catalyst for him finally getting clean?
The final catalyst, when he had a girlfriend that he used to use with and that he had lived with at one point in time, and then he had been clean for a year, and he learned that she had died of an overdose, and he had cut off contact with her for his own well-being, and he was swept with such guilt and emotion that he pawned all his belongings and tried to get enough drugs to, have an overdose and not wake up. And I was able to get hold of him, and I was driving him to another facility. We started talking about that there's something deeper going on here. There's something more, that's beyond just this addiction, because he felt that I just can't beat this thing and almost had given up. And the turning point really was he found a connection with, meditating, surfing, just kind of the outdoors and really, really connecting with the world. And in a very, he describes a spiritual way. It isn't how I believe, but it's how he believed in that connection, which I'm convinced is obviously his connection with God, is what has, turned his mindset, and really, the open communications have been there with us and the love and unconditional acceptance. And those factors are really what helped him overcome, and now he's done well for quite a while now.
So does he have clarity?
But it's never over.
Yeah, no, that's right, because there's an addiction there. But does he have clarity over the hell that he put you through? I mean, or does he only remember what you told him, so to speak? Or how much does he know and remember about that?
It's interesting. He just read the book, and he only read, when I wrote the book, he didn't want to read. He goes, I lived it. I don't want to read it. And then when he had another opportunity to read it when it was in the manuscript stage, and I offered that because I always wanted him to have that prerogative, and he declined again. And then he just finally read it about 2-3 weeks ago, and he was very sad for the first half of the book, particularly because he didn't remember how much he had put us through, and he didn't understand or comprehend the pain that he had put on his family and his siblings and all of us. And so that was very, he had a lot of sorrow and a lot of sadness around that. The book's also hopeful because it shows that it's possible to come out the other end of this horrible situation and survive and thrive. And so it's a story of hope as well. And that's really what I want to get out there, is that it's possible, and you can do it, but it won't happen by just, they need the love. They need the love and acceptance probably more than anything else. And, even though you cannot control or change whether they stay clean or not, the love and acceptance is definitely having that around them. They know somehow down deep, mostly. But when they're in the state of active use, they really don't care about anything except for where their next dose of their drug of choice is going to come from. And that's the sad reality. And they are not themselves. They don't. They do lose empathy, and they become extraordinarily self-centered and destructive.
How would you describe your relationship with them now?
It's the best it's ever been. Hmm. I'm extraordinarily close with him. He tells me his sorrows. He tells me when he's feeling a period of down coming on, we'll go kayaking or we'll go hiking, and I'm willing to drop what I have to do in my life to make sure that he's always a priority, and he knows that. And it's challenging. There's no doubt about it. It's always been challenging, but he is a sweet young man. He is a very kind-hearted, he's been the same way, that part of him, his whole life.
How old is he now?
And he's now 25 years old.
Wow.
And we just brought him home for the, again, being chastised once more by our children, although I think they finally get it now. but we brought him home in the fall, and, he was ready to get his own place, but he doesn't make enough money. Look, you got a nice place here. There's nobody, and we have none of our other children are home. So we managed to be empty nesters for all of about 3 months. But I guess that's not that uncommon in today's world.
No. And you know what? Your presence in his life is probably a treasure. I mean, I'm sure it is, and maybe there's a purpose for this season. Talking to Rick Van Warner, when we come back, I would love to know if there's a time where you let go. I mean, the parents that are listening today who've got kids who are addicted, how do you know, definitely I'm not surrendering this part, I'm going to fight till the end, and how do you know I have to let go? There's nothing else I can do. Love to know that distinction, Rick, and we'll talk about that when we return. Hope you're having a really good day today. I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise, talking to Rick Van Warner. He's a 30-year veteran of journalism, and he has a son who was in an opioid addiction for 9 years. Imagine what that family went through. We've been talking about that story. And before I ask you that question about when is it time to let go, advice for maybe parents who are listening today, how did you and your wife recover from this? Because when you're holding your breath for 9 years, I can only imagine how exhausted you must have been once you felt like you could breathe again. How did you guys recover?
Well, we never gave up on each other, and we're both, strong, I guess, through this. And I don't know if there's any one thing, but we just communicate and talk about it and keep each other propped up when one or the other gets a little too down on it, and that's about it, really.
And you really got to you have to enjoy your life. I mean, I would imagine you have to make some room to enjoy your life, even though it feels like it's imploding, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And we never did stop doing, we try to keep things as normal as possible in the house for our other children and for ourselves.
So I'm thinking of the person listening today, and they're trying to figure out, when do I let go? Do I let go? Are there some things that I surrender or some things I white knuckle to the end? I mean, how do you discern that?
Well, I don't believe that you can ever let go and or never give up hope. I mean, I think that the way I think of it is you've got to get down in the trenches and fight for them. We put ourselves in some very dangerous situations in doing so. But and my wife's a very petite woman, and she's stared down, you know, drug dealers and been in very, very, you know, without me knowing that she was going to do these things at times. So, you know, we all fought in our own way, and I don't think you ever give up or give up hope, and you never are going to quit on your kid, no matter how bad it gets. I do think that, you know, every situation is different. Certainly, my son doesn't have a violent bone in his body. So, you know, beyond yelling once or twice, I've never seen him, he rarely even loses his temper. So there was never a threat of any kind of physical violence. Certainly if you're in a situation where someone is out of their mind to the point where they could be a physical threat, then you have to let go then in terms of, you know, making sure that you're protecting the rest of your family. But we never faced that, so I can't really speak to that. In our case, we just decided that, look, he's our son. We love him. He's a great person who has a serious problem. And we will fight to the end for him, and no matter what it takes. And that's how we've approached it. I don't think you can give up. It'd be easy. It certainly would have been a much easier period of time in our lives to wave the flag, but we never did.
Wow. So when he took off, you went to find him.
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm thinking of just different parents going, I don't know what else to do. Do I let him go? So, well, that's really interesting. You also,
there are occasions where you have to.
Yeah.
I mean, there are occasions where, you know, you can drive yourself crazy trying to play detective or search around for him and then find him and find that he's not going to come with you anyway. So what are you going to do? Abduct him? I mean, and I wrote about that in the book. You know, I had a crazy period where my son and I went to New Jersey and with 100% intention of bringing him back, but he wasn't going to come. So what were we going to do?
You know, right.
Put him in a suitcase. So, you know, you have to fight, but there are times when you have to also let go and let God.
Yeah. Wow. How much did friends play a part in that for you?
They were very helpful. And I want to make this point. I think that for anybody who's struggling with a loved one or someone in your family that's got an issue of this nature, don't try to go it alone. There's a horrible stigma around opioids, particularly because of the word heroin and what that came to mean in our generation of America. This is not a Skid Row problem or inner city problem. This is something that is impacting families of every walk of American life across every socioeconomic group and in every state. This is suburban, urban, and rural. This is black, white. It doesn't matter. It's an equal opportunity destroyer. And I think that it's very important to not worry about the stigma of it and try to go it alone. You know, seek the support of your, you know, your small groups or your friends or your neighbors. You know, don't worry about what people might think. I mean, it's a life and death struggle.
Yeah.
But when you start to share openly, as we did a few years ago, all of a sudden we realize that, wow, there is a ton of families going through very similar or the very same things.
Mm. This just gripped me from your book. How this deadly public health crisis grew to today's epic proportions is maddening, particularly for those of us grappling with the agonizing journey of just trying to keep a loved one alive. So you see this on the systemic scale, on this epic scale, and then privately, all of these people walking through their own private hell because of it. I mean, what's being done? What needs to be done to kind of bring a fist down on this crisis?
Well, there's no easy answers, but I do, you know, it has been a nonpartisan failure of government. Yeah. I mean, both President Obama and President Trump have both convened presidential commissions, but done very little to act on the recommendations beyond holding nice press conferences. And there's not enough being done, frankly, on that front. I do very much believe that the first step in really attacking this. I mean, certainly there are some great band-aids that have been put in place, like Narcan, which is an anti-overdose drug that a lot of first responders and emergency rooms now have. So that's a positive step, but that's not the solution to the problem. I think the first steps are to get the stigma and the education out there about, so people better understand this problem and what to look for, and that's really what I'm trying to do. Another step is certainly enforcement of laws to crack down on the overprescribing of addictive painkillers and similar drugs, and to crack down on the trafficking of fentanyl and other substances. Those are great, but it's going to take a holistic approach that includes treatment and recovery as well. So there's several fronts that several things that need to be done. Unfortunately, very few of these are being actively chased.
Well, may God raise up more and more people to help fight this battle. I know your advocate is you're working with youth who've committed serious crimes. I mean, you're pouring back into a system that needs some desperate help. Are you comfortable, Rick, praying for on the air? I can pray if not, but just thinking of that family listening today who are heartbroken. Are you able to do that? Or?
Well, if you would say a prayer, say it.
Happy to do that.
Come along with you.
Yeah, Lord, I thank you for Rick and his family, and I pray you continue to protect, guide, and guard Tommy. Restore him beyond their wildest dreams. Restore this family. As you say, you want to restore the years the locust has eaten. I pray you'd restore every single minute that enemy has stolen from this family. I pray you'd replenish them on all sides, above and beyond their wildest dreams, Lord God. I just pray for Tommy that you'd bring him a godly girl, a woman who calls the best man out of him ever. And I pray for the families listening today who are broken, brokenhearted because they've got a wayward son or daughter. I pray you comfort them, encourage them, bring them safe friends, protect them from Job-like friends, Lord God. And I pray you'd run, chase after these kids and bring them back home again. Restore these families beyond their wildest dreams. Thank you, God, that you love us. Thank you that you give us authority to stand up against the enemy and tell him this far no more. Help us to rise up and take our place and pray for this epic crisis in our day, Lord. Help us to stand on the wall, whether it impacts us in a family or not. It impacts us. So help us to take some responsibility and do what you'd have us do and say what you'd have us say. We love you, Lord. We thank you that you're involved in our lives. In Jesus' name, amen. Rick, thank
amen.
You.
Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you for joining us today. I wish you God's absolute best.
Thank you so much.
Rick Van Warner, and his book is titled On Pills and Needles. Wow, what a show. What a story. You've been listening to Live the Promise. I'm Susie Larson. In just a bit, you'll find a podcast of today's program up on our website at myfaithradio.com. Remember this, the Lord wants you to last long and finish strong. He is the one who'll keep you strong to the end. Have a really great day.